all the episodes in the Book of Mormon took place in Latin America, in Guatemala mostly, and Central America, Southern Mexico. That's where it all took place. And all of a sudden, you find the scene in Maine County, New York. And that's where the place is buried on the farm next to where Joseph Smith lived. So the continuance of the range of the storm where they were. All right, about the golden plate. Point number one. There wasn't any gold known in America in 421 A.D. Gold had not been discovered. Now, of course, when the Spanish conquest occurred, they came and they found shiploads of golden artifacts, gold and silver. The Incas particularly. Atahualpa, the king of the Incas, was held captive by the Spanish conquistadores. They told him that he could redeem himself by filling this room that they were in with gold. They wanted to try because gold wasn't of any value. He said, if you want something real valuable, we'll give you, jade or something like this. No, they wanted gold. So they said, okay, by the next day they had the room filled with gold. They went ahead and killed that hope for anyone and kept on marauding until they had all the gold they wanted. You say, well, then there must have been plenty of gold in America. But that was in 1492, or actually 1520, by the time they got down to where the Incas were. All right. Gold was first known in America by two cultures that were the predecessors of the Incas. Incidentally, the Book of Mormon country is not the Inca country, it's Peru. It's Central America. This is the territory they claim to be the seat of all of these cities. The two cultures, the Nazca and the Southern cultures, who had some golden artifacts. The Nazcas had little pellets of gold in some of the graves that we dug up down there. You know what they had. That was the beginning of it. The Southern cultures made ornaments out of it. By this time, the Incas appeared at about the 10th century B.C., 10th century A.D., and the Aztecs came into being about the same time. Now, those two cultures were the ones that had the greatest amount of gold. But that was 600 years after the Book of Mormon was supposed to have been placed in the ground. In the second place, gold was considered to be the most worthless of the three metals that they knew about. They had copper, bronze, they learned how to make blends of metals for hardness and so forth. They had copper, they had silver, and gold. When Joseph Smith was writing the Book of Mormon, there's one occasion where he had coinage. A system of coinage with very peculiar names that was on the decimal system, same as we use, in 83 B.C., which was, of course, 1,000 years before gold came into use. But he had coinage in gold, silver, and copper. The gold being the most valuable, the silver being less, and the copper being the common metal. But actually, the natives of America considered copper to be most valuable because it was the most true value. Silver was not so valuable because it took too much effort to smother. Gold is everywhere, so this is the common place. They just use it for ornamentation. So Joseph Smith had his order reversed. This is one of the machinations of the Book of Mormon. There was no gold to make golden plates. Therefore, there was no golden plates. That seems to be a common deduction. I'm sure we all agree with that. The plan tells us to the Mormons, and they will dig up evidence, if they call evidence. They never heard of a pinpointer. I was asking, who said that? When was it said? In what book and so forth? Our bishop called it that. Which is not good evidence. Now, in the Book of Mormon, they have adorned it with many very beautiful pictures, paintings, and so forth. On this page, they show a display of metal artifacts. jewelry, ornaments, axes, and so forth. And they have below this ancient copper and bronze tools dated from the Book of Mormon period. One of the young fellows told me just a few months ago, the meeting I had, he said, well, here. I said, all of that. I looked at him and said, well, now, wait a minute. Well, I recognized quite a number of those pieces. They come from the copper culture of the Great Lakes period that started about 1300 A.D. These did not belong to the Book of Mormon period or the Book of Mormon area by 1,000 years and by 5,000 miles. But this is the receipt that they used, they showed us. Now, on this page, they show a golden plate engraved. And they say, see, golden plate. And they had even the right date, 600 B.C. And I say, well, now, just where did they find that? Let's have some detail. Then they will admit that this is a golden plate that was found in the library of Darius II in Babylon. You could say, if they were making golden plates in Babylon 600 B.C., why wouldn't they in South America? Well, how did they win? So this is the type of deceit they use when they are trying to prove that there was gold to make golden plates. Second point, nobody in that area was literate at the time. Therefore, they couldn't write a history. You say, well, what about the Maya people? They belong to that period. That's right. They wrote in their own language. They were the only literate people in America at that time. They wrote in their own language, which is a very descriptive form of letters, and they engraved on stone, not on golden plate. They didn't have golden plate. Seems to go over their head somehow or other, but if you're familiar with anything of the characters used by the Maya people, they're very peculiar and they remind you very much of Chinese. Now, I studied Chinese on two different occasions in my life, and write fairly well in Chinese, and I know the search that you have to have, and it has to be in a perfect square. All of the characters included in that particular square. It has to be like that, broken top to bottom. Well, the Maya script has exactly the same concept, the same ideas as the Chinese, which consists of ideograph, pictograph, and what we call zoomorph. Characters picturing animals. Alright. You have exactly the same thing in the Maya. You have the ideograph, you have pictograph, and you have zoomorph. So, where did they get it? Well, I'm guessing, and this is a hypothesis, we won't even call it a theory, that whoever invented the Maya script had remembered the script used in his homeland in China before he came to America, because it's very well true now that all of the American Indian people came from some part of Eastern Asia. And many of them, including in Idaho, came from China. There are many correspondences between the Chinese language and our Navajo language. Now, the evolutionary scientists will say, oh, there's no language connection between the old world and the new world. And they're very bitter about this because, and you say, well, now there's a correspondence between these languages. Oh, no, no, you're mistaken, you're mistaken. I've even had some of the witness people tell me this. But in my work with the Navajos, I made a study of this. On one occasion, I did a paper on it with the correspondence between Navajo and Chinese. They have the same tonal structure, the tonal language, all of the words carry a tone that has to be used, otherwise it doesn't make good Navajo. They have several other traits. The Navajos didn't have a written language, but they have a very concise and a very sophisticated language that has the same tone qualities, the same tone structure. It's a syllabic language, same as Navajo. It's all same as Chinese. It's boiled down to a single syllable. Each idea is boiled down to a single syllable, and these have grown together in the case of the Navajo, what is called an agglutinative language. Chinese is not. It has single syllables, and each one carries a definite meaning. Well, of the 385 possible sounds in Chinese, which are amplified, of course, by the tone, and also by the written character and the context, so that the language can be expanded without limit. Out of those 385, I've discovered 260 of them in the Navajo language, the same sound, which have some of the same vocabulary. We have the ancient name of God embedded in the Navajo language, the same as the Chinese have, the same form exactly. So we know that whatever literary skill came or is developed in America developed evidently out of a former knowledge, a prior knowledge of a language in the old world. None of that, of course, corresponds with the Book of Mormon. They have no written language except the Maya. Totally Egyptian, different from the Egyptian which Joseph Smith said this book was written on. It's inscribed in Egyptian. Well, there's no trace of Egyptian language in any of the American Indian languages. All of the American Indian languages, which would include the 8 or 9 tribes that were in the area, including the Book of Mormon area, all of those people have a relationship. The old Mesa, for instance, corresponds to a degree with the Maya. They're all Chiche language. And the only written form was the Maya, and in turn, the old Mesa did have something of that at one time, but it was lost. And the Zapotec in the south had a written language at one time, but it was lost before they engraved anything permanently. So the Book of Mormon could not have been written between 600 B.C. and 421 A.D. in their language in America because they didn't have a written language and they were not literate people, unless it was the Maya, and you know that the Maya is nothing like the Egyptian. Now the Egyptian, if they isn't that written in hieroglyphics, yes it is. Picture language, a sort of a reader type of writing. But it's nothing like the Maya language. The two are just as far, both of them have elements of pictographs in them. They're totally different. Same different philosophy entirely. So, from that standpoint, the Book of Mormon cannot be true. It was not translated out of Egyptian, no Egyptian is present in the American continent. There is no gold in which to inscribe it, because there was no gold in America at that time. They didn't know gold. And so much for the actual writing of the book. Now, what actually condemns the book more than anything else is the anachronisms in the text of the Book of Mormon. Anachronism is simply something that's out of time and place. For instance, Christ said that Washington crossed the Delaware with a 75-horse outboard motor and stormed the Trenton with screaming tanks, he'd say, well, he's trying to make fun out of it. Well, that's an anachronism. He did it on foot with very tired soldiers, if you remember. But anyway, the book is full of anachronism. For instance, and I think this will probably be all we will need to mention. In the Book of Mormon, olives are mentioned 15 times. America never had an indigenous olive. They all came, the olives came with the Spaniards after 1492. So it has 15 mentions of olives in the Book of Mormon, which was totally out of sight, so they didn't know anything about olives. Also, we find that, among other things, field grains such as barley and wheat. Field crops are mentioned 31 times in the Book of Mormon. No grain was ever known on the American continent except corn, maize, until the time of the conquest. They didn't plant in fields, they planted corn in hills, and the culture is a very simple one. They didn't cultivate the fields and plow them as the Eastern New Yorkers did in Joseph Smith's time. They burned over an area. They had what they call slash and burn agriculture. They would go into the jungle and they would burn off an area of 2 acres, you would say, and burn that all up, all of the trees and everything else. Then they would go into that with their planting stick, which the man carried. They'd make a hole, and the woman would drop the kernels of corn in that hole. And they would go over the 2 acre patch and they would have a splendid crop of corn. The man couldn't drop the kernels, the woman had to do it. Because fertility is always associated with the woman. And our Hopi Indians are doing exactly the same today in 1981 in Arizona. You see them out in the field, the man with the sticks and the woman with the sack of corn, and she's dropping it. And they have a ritual that they go through after they get it all printed so that they're planted so that it will be a good crop. Well, there was no wheat, no barley, no rye, no oats in America until they came with the Europeans. Field crops were never planted until they produced areas suitable for cultivation. They didn't cultivate the corn crop, they just let it grow up by itself. And they had thrashing instruments mentioned in the Book of Mormon. They didn't thrash corn. They sell. And all the way through. And they had all of the tools of agriculture. Well, there were no tools of agriculture except pointed sticks in ancient America. So this is what we call an anachronism. So they couldn't have been there because they didn't know that sort of thing. Now, also, iron is mentioned. Swords and spears and scimitars are mentioned, and agricultural tools of metal are mentioned many times in the Book of Mormon. In fact, we have in the early chapters of the Book of Mormon, when the prophet came from Europe, from Asia, the Jews came from Jerusalem in 600 B.C. and settled in ancient America. There was a total of probably 24 people in the company by this time, because they give the names and the ages and all the rest of it. But soon after they came, they quarreled. The two families quarreled, the Lamanites and the Nephites. And they joined into two separate armies, and we find Nephi making many swords for their protection. Well, there would be fully 8 adults on each side and a lot of babies. So quite a war that would be, wouldn't it? But he has been making steel swords. Steel hadn't been invented for another 1,500 years. Iron was not known in ancient America. There was never an iron age in America until the Europeans came. Yet he has been using iron on many, many occasions. He had horses and chariots. The wheel was never used in ancient America. So what about the potter's wheel? They didn't use potter's wheel. And I hope the Indians today don't use the potter's wheel. They use the braiding weapon and the shaking with their hands and so forth. They still don't use the potter's wheel. So the wheel was not known. Now the principle was known because they used to move huge stones on rollers. So the idea of something round that rolls was known and used. But they didn't have horses and chariots. There were no horses there. There was no such thing as a draft animal used in ancient America. Or a pack animal except the llama in South America. They had dogs, but only the northern Indians used them with little travois. That's the way they carried some of their bunks. They had no horses. The horse wasn't known until after the Spaniards came. In fact, this was a great mystery to these people. These huge animals that people rode on, they were afraid of them, and this enabled them to overcome those Indians because they were afraid of these huge animals that these men would ride. They never knew nothing. They never knew anything about horses. The wheel was not known, so they couldn't have chariots. warfare is mentioned repeatedly, and the ancient Americans were notably peaceful. You don't read of any wars or conquests any place in ancient America. It's always peaceful, except little wars when the young fellows would go out and shoot a few animals or something and bring them back just for the sake of plants more than anything else. And no such thing as wars, and yet you have destructive wars with hundreds of thousands of people in. And there weren't that many people in America at the time. So, all of these things, the Book of Mormon is replete with them. Now, of the things that are mentioned, I didn't know that I was here someplace. Domestic animals. Asses, bulls, calves, cattle, herds, flocks, goats, horses, sheep, oxen, and swine are all mentioned many times. None of these animals are indigenous in America, and none of them were there before the Europeans brought them. And yet we have them repeatedly in the Book of Mormon, as early as 600 BC, which of course is totally out of character for America. Now, so much for the anachronisms of the Book of Mormon. We don't need to, oh yes, incidentally, they had fine linen mentioned 15 times in the Book of Mormon. I wonder where they got the expression fine linen. Very obvious, isn't it? Linen is not known in America until it was brought in England to the colonies in Massachusetts. That's the first crop that was ever brought to America. Silk is mentioned 6 times in the Book of Mormon. What are the facts? Silk has never grown profitably in America. The Chinese tried it, the British tried it, but it was never a success, and silk has never been produced commercially in America. Yet they had it many times in ancient America. We could go on and on. The book is full of these, but we say these are the evidences that the Book of Mormon is not true. It was manufactured, it was written by folks who knew the culture of the people in up in New York State. They were the ones that they were thinking, why shouldn't they be doing it in Mexico if we're doing it in New York State? Well, the fact is they were. And we know from history that they were. So much to that. That's the Book of Mormon. There are many other, I'm doing a book at the present time on the anachronism and bad guesses in the Book of Mormon. And that's the way I'm going to title it, sir. For instance, we have, in the very beginning of the book, this migration out of Jerusalem of this family, which eventually became 2 families, a total of 18 people, that sailed for America in 580 B.C. And they came out of Jerusalem into the desert at the command of the Lord. And the Lord had told Jeremiah, so the stranger who didn't submit to the captivity, but the Lord told this man to take his family and leave. Same time. Which of course is a contradiction. Now, this is part of the narrative as they travel in the desert, the Arabian desert, across the Jordan and south. Why? Because they mention it. He came down by the borders near the shore of the Red Sea, and he traveled in the wilderness in the borders which are near the Red Sea, and he did travel in the wilderness with his family, which consisted of my mother, Sariah, and my elder brothers, who were Laman, Lemuel, and Sam. It came to pass that when he had traveled 2 days in the wilderness, he pitched his tent in a valley by the side of a river of water. Now, see if you can get the point here that I'm going to make before I make it. Pitched his tent in the valley by the side of a river of water. There came to pass that he built an altar of stones and made an offering unto the Lord and gave thanks unto the Lord our God. And it came to pass that he called the name of the river Laman after one of the boys. And it entered into the Red Sea, and the valley was in the border near the mouth thereof. And when my father saw that the waters of the river emptied into the fountain of the Red Sea, he spake unto Laman, saying, O that thou mightest be like unto this river, running continually into the fountain of all righteousness. A very high statement. What's the problem? Have you ever looked at the relief map of Arabia? There are no rivers in Arabia. There isn't a single river running into the Red Sea in any of the 1,800 miles of its borders on either side. There isn't any river that could run into the Red Sea. Now, there are two wadis in Arabia down toward the south, the Wadi Hadramut, which runs laterally and empties into the Arabian Sea when it runs, which is very seldom, once every 25 years, they have water in that, down near Aden. Then there's another that comes down from north to south that's placed on the map. This wadi, where water is there only when they have rainfall, which is very seldom in the Arabian Peninsula. But this man found a river of water in a valley, and he stayed there, and they stayed there for some time and refreshed themselves by this river. Obviously, Joseph Smith never looked at the relief map of the land of Arabia. So this is the sort of thing we run into constantly. We find them when they're landed in America, the first thing we do is to build a temple. And they're still only 9 adults and a lot of kids. But they built a temple. And he said, I would teach my people to build buildings and to work in all manner of wood and of iron and of copper and of brass and of steel and of gold and of silver and of precious stones, which were in great abundance, all perfectly untrue, of course. And I, Nephi, did build a temple. And I did construct it after the manner of the temple of Solomon, say that were not built of so many precious things, for they were not to be found upon the earth. In the verse before, he says they were there in abundance, now he says they weren't there, so they couldn't do it. And he built a temple for 9 adults and 12, 15 youngsters. So, this is the Book of Mormon. It's just full of these discrepancies, and if you want to do anything with the Book of Mormon, just go through and underline the things that you're going to use to take time in the morning before it comes here with the Book of Mormon. So if it's so, can't be so, be taught. There's the reason. Alright. Just a minute. Describe the Doctrine and Covenant. Joseph Smith was constantly running into the fact that folks didn't believe what he was telling them. He was a profound liar. He never told the truth if he couldn't help it. Same is true of his mother and father. They were known as the most indigent people in the community and the worst liars. He never could take their word for anything. So when he was giving instructions to the boys, he had to have authority for it. So he said, "Thus saith the Lord to you, Joseph Smith, so and so." So he writes it down. I, the Lord, say unto you, here's one, I am Alpha and Omega, Christ the Lord, yea, even I am He, the beginning and the end, the ruler of the world, and so forth. And this is prefacing instructions concerning some trivial matters that were going on. In other words, you have to have authority, so he invoked the Almighty for his authority. This ranges all the way from 1828 to 1840. From the final item is listed. The total great price contains scriptures written by Joseph Smith to substantiate some of the doctrines that he was teaching them concerning the plurality of God and the fact that blacks had no right to the priesthood. All of this you have to establish by scripture. And so he writes in here. It's a compilation of several different things. There's a book of Moses, visions that were had with Moses on the mountain of God and so forth, all various things. And then the Book of Abraham. Now the Book of Abraham contains all these doctrines, these crazy doctrines that he hadn't thought of when the Book of Mormon was written, or the Doctrine of Covenant. This is something that came later. So, here's what he has as a heading, a translation of some ancient records that had fallen into our hands from the catacombs of Egypt. The writings of Abraham, while he was in Egypt, called the Book of Abraham, written by his own hand upon papyrus. And they have Egyptian figures here, several of them throughout the book, that he found in this scroll of papyrus, and he copied them. You can see that he wasn't a very good copyist, but you recognize it as something that was taken from an Egyptian bit of papyrus. Now, this establishes the fact of the plurality of God and several other doctrines that no one in the line of Cain, he has Cain's descendants as being the black. This is the mark of Cain that they were made to be black people. How they got through the flood, you don't know, because Abraham lived after the flood, and all of these doctrines could apply to the period. Well, in the first place, Abraham wasn't in Egypt long enough to write any such thing as this. Second place, he wouldn't have written on papyrus. Abraham would have written it on cuneiform and clay tablets. That was his writing style from early to call. You know how he wrote. He had plenty of clay tablets from that period showing what he would have written. Now, these Egyptian papyri were found in money that Joseph Smith's mother had bought in a traveling showman in 1835. And of course, Joseph unwrapped them and he found these papyri and said, this is a great one. Nobody knows Egyptian. They won't know whether I'm studying or not. So I'll translate the Book of Abraham from these Egyptian writings, which he did. Egyptian at that time had not been discovered. There was one man in France, Champollion, who was making a dictionary, or attempting to make a dictionary of the Egyptian language as it was taken from the Rosetta Stone, which was trilingual, I believe. Anyway, they were not having much success, and Joseph Smith knew nothing about it, and he figured, well, this is a good way to veil this thing. Nobody will ever know. So he translated the Book of Abraham, many chapters, including a repetition of the early chapters of Genesis, in which it says the God made man, and so forth. All the Jews returned to God. Okay. All right, here's the Book of Abraham, and the faithful believers. Well, what happened to the Egyptian papyrus? Asked them up until a few years ago, and they say, well, they were destroyed in the Chicago fire. Which is a pretty good disposal for such things. But in 1962, the curator of the Museum of Natural History in New York discovered that he was in possession of this roll of papyrus. So he made the grand gesture of giving it back to the Mormon Church, but not until they photographed. Now, Egyptian, anyone who knows the old languages can read Egyptian. But that is not so in Joseph Smith's day. So when this happened, the Mormons were jubilant. They said, now we can prove that the Pearl of Great Price is true. So they submitted the papyrus to several Egyptologists among their own people and others, two or three of their own, including Dr. Hugh Nibley in Salt Lake, William Provo, who is a very erudite scholar. And after he had translated some of them, and they had identified them, they discovered that these were nothing more or less than funerary documents from about the time of Christ, not from the time of Abraham. And Joseph Smith had declared that these were found in the time of Abraham, or they're from the time of Abraham. One of these mummies, actually, he said, was Pharaoh's daughter. And another was Pharaoh Nephi, the king. Well, obviously, a completely common. Well, when they discovered that this was not true, this man Hugh Nibley, who is now an old man, he said, this is the worst thing that has happened to us in the history of the church. Because he had nothing to do with the Book of Abraham or the time of Abraham. They're from the time of Christ, and they're nothing more or less than the horoscopes that they put in the wrappings in the mummy when they buried it. Horoscopes, hypercephali, put under their head. That he shows one of them here, and there's someone who said there are down a dozen. You know what they are, and you know that they have nothing to do with the time of Abraham or the circumstance. So, and one of their men, a man by the name of Nelson, a man who was an Egyptologist, was told to translate these so that it could vindicate Joseph Smith's writings before the great Christ. He started in, and before he got more than started, he wrote to the church in Salt Lake City, and he said, "I am resigning from the Mormon Church. I will not be a member of any church that would use such deception as this." Well, he did resign. They tried to hush him up, but they couldn't. And his findings have been published, and he shows exactly what these things are. They have nothing to do with the time or the people. So that's the pearl of great price. It is an absolute hope, as is the Doctrine and Covenants and the Book of Mormon. There are absolute hopes all the way through. Joseph Smith, as I said, never told the truth. He certainly never tried to tell the truth. He may have told the truth on two occasions, but nobody knows about it. He lied about the first vision. He lied about the angel that came. He lied about the golden plate. He lied about the translation of the golden plate. And he lied about the Book of Abraham, which substantiates the doctrine of many gods and so forth. He's a profound liar, and his book proved it. Now you say, well, why would anybody do anything like that? Well, I think we have the answer in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. The apostle writing there is writing about the end time when a man of sin will be manifested. And we feel that these things are happening right now. The events of the last few days, to me, are quite significant. But in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul is writing about this one, this wicked one, who will be revealed with all deceivableness of unrighteousness, and then will perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion, that they may believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believe not the truth. In other words, the end times will be characterized by teachings that are lies that men will believe so that God will have a basis of judgment. The judgment because of their unbelief. Now, there's nothing that qualifies for this so much as the writings of Joseph Smith and the doctrines of the Mormon Church. They're profoundly untrue. And they are constructed in such a way that people are actually believing the lie unwittingly. They could know that it was a lie if they studied it out, but they aren't thinking. People don't think, and they accept these doctrines. And I say that those who are being saved out of Mormonism, and there are quite a few, not as many as are going into Mormonism, but it seems to me that the process that is going on in the gathering together of these groups of unbelieving people who are willing to accept the Mormon doctrine, the ether at the end of the year is gathering together in pundits to be born. And the fact that they're believing a lie is that which separates the true from the false. And the Lord is giving us the opportunity of snatching some of these folks out of the room. They're not committed to it, they're not studied it deeply enough to know whether they believe it or not. Now, many of them, when we bring out some of these things, do you believe that? Well, no. Well, that's what the Mormon teaches. I didn't know that. So they come out and they say, all right, now you tell us, what should we do next? Time is gone. Are there some quick questions on this? I realize this has been pretty heavy stuff all the way through, but that's it. But you should know it, because this is an important thing in dealing with Mormons, to know that their writings are absolutely false and be able to show them why you believe them. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. They will say that. It doesn't matter what you say. I still believe the Bible, or the Book of Mormon, is the Word of God, and Joseph Smith is the prophet of God. If they are convinced. I was talking to one fellow about these golden plates. I said, do you think you could carry these golden plates 3 miles? And he was quite angry with me because I was saying things about the Book of Mormon. He said, if the Bible, or if the record said they weighed 1,000 pounds, I believe the Lord would give him power enough to carry them. I still believe the Book of Mormon to the Word of God and trust it to be the Prophet of God. Now, there are all that kind of responses. We find more of them than we do the other. Others say, well, wait a minute now, I didn't know all of that. Let's study this then. And we've had staunch Mormons come to salvation as a result of the problems that we pose with regard to the writings of Mormon. There are those who think. There are quite a few people in the world who think. There are some who don't.
I'd like to take the opportunity at this time to again reiterate that this is a 5-message series by Gordon Fraser on the subject of Is Mormonism Christian? We have just finished the third of the 5 sessions. I'd like to at this time review the outline and look ahead to the messages yet to come. On the first case, the subject was the doctrine of God, as the Mormons see it, and as the Bible presents it. On the second case, the subject matter is Jesus Christ, how the Mormons view Jesus Christ, and how the Bible views Jesus Christ. Tonight's message was on the writing of the Mormons. The next message, number 4, will be on Mormonism and Christian history. The final message on tape number 5 will consist of some practical help in the matter of presenting salvation to Mormons. I would further like to use this opportunity to possibly quote some of their own scriptures, that is, scriptures from the Book of Mormon. At our series of meetings, there was a number of Mormons who attended almost each night. During the time afterward, the discussions were very lively and very good. Some of these portions from their scriptures might be helpful as you speak with them. In the Book of Mormon, there is a book called Alma. Alma, chapter 7 and verse 10 says this, "And behold, he shall be born of Mary at Jerusalem, which is in the land of our forefathers, she being a virgin, a pregnant chosen vessel." Now this is a portion, of course, which is a clear inaccuracy concerning the birth of our Lord Jesus Christ. This can be found in the Book of Mormon on page 211 and 212. Another portion, which might be very helpful, can be found in the Book of Mormon, the Book of Jacob, chapter 2, page 111, which concerns the matter of polygamy. Such as verse 23, "But the word of God burdens me because of your gross crime. For behold, thus saith the Lord, his people begin to wax in iniquity. They understand not the scripture, for they seek to excuse themselves in committing whoredom, because of the things which were written concerning David."